he's told some Cub Scouts once, 7-year-olds or so, who before a game, he said, kids, the two most important words in the English language are love and balance. And I'm saying, can you imagine that? I mean, coming from this incredible basketball coach and all the rest of it, that's where he was looking at it all. In other words, he had the overview on everything.
That was Neville Johnson talking about legendary UCLA basketball coach John Wooden, and you are listening to episode 46 of the All Things Risk podcast. Welcome and welcome back to the All Things Risk podcast. My name is Ben Cattaneo. I'm your host. This is my show. What do we do here? Around here, we do long-form conversations where I use the lenses of risk and uncertainty to cover all types of topics. I talk to risk takers. I talk big picture issues. I talk resilience. And my objective is that you find these conversations insightful, entertaining, and certainly useful. I don't expect you to agree necessarily with everything my guests say. I certainly don't. But I do hope that they provide you with a different way of looking at things and that you take what works for you. You can discard the rest. I don't mind. I'm a Canadian based in London. My guests are from all over the world, as is my audience. And this is a bit of a side project for me. I work in risk professionally, but I'm fascinated about risk and randomness and uncertainty and all of that good stuff and just about any context. So it's an excuse that I have to have some really interesting conversations with some great people. Speaking of which, let's get on with this week's episode. My guest is Neville Johnson. Neville is a lawyer in Hollywood, California, in the United States. He's represented a number of very famous actors, artists, musicians, writers, particularly around royalties and profits and against the bullying tactics of big companies. He's represented the likes of the Beatles and many others. And we do talk about that, but that's not the main reason why I invited Neville onto the show. Neville is many things besides a lawyer. And one of those things is he's an author, and he's written two books and has spent a significant amount of time with someone that I consider and many others consider to be one of the greatest coaches in American athletics, and I'd say anywhere in the world. That person is UCLA legendary basketball coach John Wooden. UCLA stands for University of California at Los Angeles. Neville wrote two books on John Wooden. One of them was an authorized biography entitled The John Wooden Pyramid of Success, and the second was a book about sayings by John Wooden called Woodenisms. Now, who is John Wooden? He was one of the most successful coaches in the history of collegiate basketball in the United States. Collegiate sports in the United States is huge. And John Wooden has a coaching record that I think will never be matched. He's won 10 national championships in the 1960s and 70s, 7 in a row. And at one point, his teams had a run of 3 years where they never lost a match. He's coached many famous players such as Lew Alcindor, who you might know as Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Bill Walton, amongst others. Now, there's an amazing thing about John Wooden. He never actually talked about winning, even though he had all of this success. Winning to him was the outcome of the process of hard work that he instilled in his teams. And there's a lot of deep wisdom in the way that John Wooden went about coaching and teaching. He was actually a lot more than a basketball coach. And if you know nothing about basketball, you'll still get a huge amount of great stuff from this conversation. John Wooden was a teacher. He was a psychologist, a philosopher, a poet. And he passed away in 2010, but he's the purveyor of some timeless wisdom. And Neville and I discuss that. We talk about what it was like for Neville to speak and work with John, John Wooden's famous pyramid of success, how he had, how John Wooden had an influence on Neville's own work as a lawyer. And Neville is one of the most feared lawyers in Hollywood. He's taken on some of the big corporations and has won, has been very successful. We talk about privacy law, or privacy law as we say it here in the UK, and a lot more. Neville joined me via Skype. The sound quality, I think, could have been a bit better in spots. That tends to happen every now and then, depending on internet connections and things like this. There is a bit of risk to that, but it does work, and the content is fabulous. So without any further delay, I want to present to you Neville Johnson. Enjoy. The All Things Risk podcast. It's a pleasure to have you on, and I think we're going to have a great conversation. So welcome.
Thank you.
And you're dialing in from Los Angeles, California, which, as we were talking before we began, is pretty amazing. We couldn't do this even 10 years ago. So it's wonderful to be able to connect and have these kinds of conversations. What attracted me and caught my attention was your books on John Wooden. Now, a lot of my listeners will know who he is, but many won't. And I think he's probably the greatest coach, or one of the greatest coaches of any sport of perhaps all time. And I'm curious as to how you got involved in writing two books about him. And maybe, first of all, who you are. And then we'll get into who he is, and then we'll move from there.
Well, I'm an entertainment attorney in Beverly Hills, California. I predominantly represent talent, going against the big studios and the record companies for net profits and royalties that are due. But copyright infringement is my area, and the right of privacy and defamation I'm very involved in as well.
Mm-hmm.
I got involved with John Wooden back around 1982 or so, when I saw something he had created called the Pyramid of Success. And I asked a friend who created this. He goes, John Wooden. I said, the basketball coach? Mm. Because I had grown up nearby where he had coached. He said, yes. And I was interested in that because at that time I had achieved my goal as a lawyer, which was to represent the biggest group in the history of rock and roll, which is the Beatles. And I was the lawyer for Yoko Ono and the estate of John Lennon. And I thought to myself, well, this is what success is, what he says. And he says that success is peace of mind, which is a direct result of self-satisfaction, and knowing you made the effort to become your best, with the key ingredients being enthusiasm, hard work, and going after a great difficult challenge. But I should also preface this, I don't want to be too long-winded, by explaining who John Wooden is. And he is generally considered to be the greatest coach in the history of athletics in the United States of America. And I don't think it's debatable. Hmm. He really was. And that's because he has a number of what I call not only unequaled records, but unapproachable records. In other words, he won the national championship 7 years in a row, which is unbelievable. He had three perfect seasons, for example. And then he was just, he's famous for popularizing what we call the full court press, which was a technique used in basketball that made the other teams utterly crazy, etc. And he was as famous, I think, as the Beatles or Elvis Presley in sports. And now they give an award away every year. It's called the John Wooden Award, to the best basketball player and college player in the country, etc. And he's still lionized and considered to be, you know, the greatest coach. But beyond that, he was this philosopher, and his influence has gone far beyond athletics.
He's a philosopher, scholar, poet, you know, all of these wonderful things that transcend the Transcend Athletics, really. And one of the things I, when you talked about the his definition of success, that is, it's almost counterintuitive to the success that he achieved as a professional coach and also as a player, because he didn't talk about winning very much, which I think
he never used the word winning, mm-hmm. ever. He mm-hmm. would say, "We outscored the opponents," which I thought was great. You know, another thing, another aspect of him was he said, "Never be emotional. Always just play your game. Don't get high after a win, and don't get low after a defeat." And his daughter, when I interviewed her, said, "Unless you had been at the game, you would have no idea who had won that when they were home."
That's a wonderful way of looking at the world. And what was he like as a human being? What was it like working with him?
Well, you know, first of all, I was fortunate to interview him 7 times, and then he was kind enough to allow me to interview his friends, family, brothers, players, everybody in his life. And I came to my job as a lawyer is to catch people in the noise and to take them down, and you know, that's how you, to show the other side is wrong. So I did my best to try and figure out, just find all the bad stuff about John Wooden, and I got to tell you, he's a saint. He is just a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful guy. There is one funny story where he said he never swore except when he was about 10 years old and his father boxed his ears. I said, "Hey, coach, I found this guy who said that in 1932, after a high school basketball game, you took a swing at the other coach and called him an SOB." And he says, "Neville, I did take a swing at him. I did not call him an SOB, and I have witnesses." So anyway, he's told some Cub Scouts once, 7-year-olds or so, who before a game, he said, "Kids, the two most important words in the English language are love and balance." Mm-hmm. Love and balance. And I'm saying, can you imagine that? I mean, coming from this incredible basketball coach and all the rest of it, that's where he was looking at it all. In other words, he had the overview on everything. And he was a very nice person. His daughter would tell a story of, like, we'd be at the hotel and he's out there talking to the parking attendant. And we got to, come on. And some guy sits next to him at a game and chats him up, and they say, "Who was that?" He goes, "Oh, just another person who I don't know his name." You know, in other words, everybody had the time of day and was treated with equanimity. And that was something very special about him. He was truly a kind person.
Did you take anything? I mean, you're clearly an accomplished lawyer, and before we get into that, where did your paths intersect? How did it, you know, come about that, you know, you talked about this pyramid of success, but you had achieved a lot. Where do these things meet for you?
Well, I had a lot of ups and downs since that period of time when I first became acquainted with it, and it's been a long, somewhat troubled times journey to where I'm at now. I have a 9-person law firm, and we're doing great. But he motivated me. That's what this did. This book motivated me to show that through grit, hard work, determination, being focused, I could achieve my goals. And that's what I tell law students when I teach them now. I said, if I can make it, you can make it. Anybody can make it. And, you know, here's a guy who came from, I'll call him, humble origins, somewhat in Indiana. But he achieved the greatest heights, the highest heights in sports, while keeping his equilibrium. And I'd like to think that I've hopefully learned from him how to keep it all in perspective. I know sometimes over my career, I was too focused on my work life and to the detriment of my personal life. And I think that this is, you know, by thinking about what he did and how he did it, is just good sob for the soul.
Right. And were you, so you talked about your various ups and downs. Were you able then to take some of the, I mean, one or two things maybe that he provided to you that you managed to change and translate into your professional success? Because what's great about some of his philosophies is it's not just about basketball or athletics. They're applicable to all aspects of life, which I think that's why he...
I think it was just the recognition that, you know, this too will pass, whatever the hardship is that one is facing at any given time. And to be dogged and unafraid, you know, in my career I've had some great success taking on big corporations and helping to advance the law to some degree, and I would say that because of Wood's influence, I was had the willingness to and ability to do that overall. In other words, one can accomplish anything. He gives you hope, and he was an optimist, it helped me to be an optimist. I mean, things I look on the bright side of life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What would you think he would make of the modern athlete in the digital age?
This is what I write about in the book, is that heroes are hard to find. Heroes are hard to come by. So many of them, whether it be politicians, actors, celebrities, sports heroes, mm-hmm. they lead lives that are less than perfect at times. Wooden has no Mars on his life or career, really, although there was some criticism, and there will always be some criticism about one particular booster who had undue influence, they say, with respect to some of the athletes. But overall, he led a life without much in the way of criticism overall. I mean, he was kind of a goody-goody of sorts. And I think, you know, for the great athletes of today, he appreciated them, but he understood and said that they had an obligation to live up to their role that they had overall, and he was disappointed when athletes, you know, fell down overall. But, you know, he was a forgiving person. I'll give you another story about a Wooden that really struck home for me. So Watergate was, of course, the great national scandal 40 years ago, and the president's chief of staff was a guy named Bob Haldeman, and he went to prison. John Wooden visited him in prison twice, and I interviewed Haldeman. And he knew Haldeman because Haldeman had helped been a fundraiser for Pauley Pavilion, which was the arena that was created for UCLA under Wooden. And he said, Bob Haldeman is a good man. He paid his price. He comes from a good family, and I'm his friend. And I thought, here's the most guy who has the most highest level of rectitude considered by other people visiting this person who was reviled at the time. But he was a friend. He was a friend to that guy, and I came to appreciate overall. So Wooden was a forgiving man also, but I'll tell you something else. Wooden never said anything bad about anybody, ever. And I interviewed a guy he went to high school with in Indiana. He said that was John Wooden. He just never said a bad thing about anybody. And I thought, well, there you go. You know, it shows how you can lead a life and do that. I mean, there are people other coaches who said nasty stuff about Wooden. They didn't like him at all. They were bitter, you know, that he had, I guess, the kind of success that he had. But he was, you know, he had a million friends. I'll give you another aspect about Wooden, which I think is telling. So when he was a coach, he was, you know, the teacher, and there were rules, and and he enforced them, and there was that, I'm not going to call it a barrier, but there was that separation between student and teacher. After they graduated, he became friends with virtually every player that he ever had. Mm-hmm. And so when I went back to Kentucky, because he spent a year or two coaching in Kentucky in high school ball after he graduated from college, guys told me he came into a room, he hadn't seen him in 50 years, and he goes, John, Bob, Bill. He knew all their names. That. But when I talked to him, he knew where, it was like 188 players, he knew where 160 of them were and was in touch with them.
Wow.
Overall. He was their friend. And that was the other thing, too. He went from coach to mentor and friend at the same time. And I thought that's somewhat extraordinary from, you know, whether it be a coach or somebody who's a former boss or a teacher, whatever it may be, to have that continued involvement in their lives, which he wanted and they wanted too.
Yes. I think one of the things I love about Coach Wooden, all I know is from what I've listened to and read, and so I've never met the man, never been in his presence, but the focus on the inward focus on success and the focus on the team and the kind of the diminishment of egos and individuals and the focus on the collective. And how, you know, how difficult that is to achieve in a modern organization, a business. You know, it's very difficult to get people working for one another. And he was clearly remarkable at getting people to work with leaders as opposed to telling them what to do. And that's what comes across. I'm just curious in terms of the work that you've done with him, how, you know, again, how genuine that is or not.
Well, he said to me that he took so many courses on psychology, mm-hmm. he could have gotten a degree in it.
Hmm.
And he said that it's not the most talented players you put on a team, but those who work best with each other. Then he had phrases that he would say, like, the star is the rest of the team. Isn't it amazing how much can be accomplished if nobody cares who gets the credit? Things like that. So he was as much a psychologist as he was telling them how to the techniques of basketball. Mm. And he never stopped trying to ensure that he had the best team at the best any best given time. You know, in other words, to keep them all working coherently and effectively. I want to say another thing too is that, well, he certainly had some favorites. One guy, Bill Walton, amongst others.
Sure.
I guess you could say a favorite, but he, you know, his influence affected everybody from the. For the most part, from the managers, you know, the ball boys and water boys, et cetera, to the guys who sat on the bench all the time. I mean, they were thrilled to play for and with him overall. And I think that, you know, because he would lose his temper, you would know he was angry when he would say, "Goodness gracious sakes alive!" That was saying, "I am really upset."
Right.
So I think he was for. He says that one of the things, you know, is to be an effective coach, you need to basically know what you're talking about, and two, have the rapport with the players, such that because you cannot demand their respect, you have to earn it overall. Mm. That's what he could do. I mean, he showed them how to do it.
Can you talk a little bit about this the pyramid of success that he created?
Well, in 1932, he was teaching at South Bend Central High in Indiana, and he said parents would come and say, "Why isn't Johnny doing better or getting better grades overall?" And so he had been familiar with something called a ladder of success, and he started creating his own what he called the pyramid of success, and it took him, I think, about 12 years to put it together. And he would give that out to students and to players and talk about it. And it had, I mean, just listen to what the elements are. So I mentioned at the beginning, industrious and enthusiasm are the cornerstones. Mm. And he said, there's no substitute for work. Mm. Then he says, enthusiasm. And I think this is critical, is that nobody should be in a job that they don't like.
Mm.
And I asked him, well, what should a person do who's in a job that they don't like? Just try to get out of it as soon as possible. And that's something you do. I mean, we only go around the planet once, and too many people are stuck. So he said, industrious enthusiasm, he's got friendship, loyalty, cooperation, self-control, alertness, initiative, intentness, meaning set a realistic goal.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing, he's a pragmatist, set a realistic goal. Have team spirit. You got to have skill. You got to be in condition. You got to have poise and confidence and at the top competitive greatness. Go for it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And then up the mortar, he called it, ambition, adaptability, resourcefulness, fight, faith, patience, integrity, reliability, honesty, and sincerity. So he put all those things together with the fundamental underlying notion that you just have to do your best all the time.
Yeah.
Which is imperfect, but he says you can never achieve perfection, but you should always be striving for it. And so I like the philosophy because it's non-sectarian.
Yep.
And it's totally utilitarian and pragmatic.
Yes.
And made sense. And, you know, worked for him.
Yes, clearly. And what I like about it as well, as somebody who's into risk and uncertainty, it's a great way of managing uncertainty. Because you can't control, and he talks about control. You can't control, well, you can't worry about things that you can't control. You can worry about the work that you put in. You can worry about all of the things you talked about. And hopefully the results take care of themselves. And if they don't, they don't. But that's all you can do.
Hey, by the way, let's mention the two books. One's called
The
John Wooden Pyramid of Success. That's my biography of him.
Mm-hmm.
And the other one is called Woodenisms, mm-hmm. which is a collection of his sayings, which just makes a perfect gift for any household.
I'll put the links in the show notes, and I went through Woodenisms today, and you know, I love, there's so many quotes that are wonderful. But do you have a favorite? Do you have one that sticks with you?
Well, I'll give you his two most that are best known, and I'll give you a couple that I like. One is failing to prepare is preparing to fail, and the other one is it's what you've learned after you know it all. That counts. And also this one is very famous. Be quick, but don't hurry.
Yes.
The ones I liked are the athlete who says something cannot be done should never interrupt the athlete who is doing it.
Right, yeah, yeah.
And the softest pillow is a clear conscience.
Yes, yes. Cool. Yeah, and these are, you know, these are timeless. Are these things that he just that he's collected along the way, or that's just come out, or how do you research a book like that?
I think a lot of them he came up with, and some of them I know he took from others. I know there was somebody named Pearl Mesta, and the quote that he liked that he said of hers was, "Those that mind don't matter; those that matter don't mind."
Right, right. I'll give you my favorite. It's There Are No Secrets. I love that one because, you know, and in the modern age, and we can get into a little bit about some of your work as well. But I think in the kind of modern, quick digital age, we're very interested in hacking our way to success. We're always, you know, many viral posts have, you know, the one secret that they don't want you to know, or, you know, this kind of thing. And we're very used to now, getting much more used to clicking and on Amazon, buying something and it arrives in an hour. And, you know, this kind of almost instant gratification type of culture. And I think we're losing some of the timeless qualities of what he taught. And one of them is, you know, there are no secrets to success or to achievement. And
he would say, with respect to when he played the games, that, you know, there was no secrets to how UCLA played its basketball. We just roll into town and mow them down.
Yeah.
And he never scouted the other team.
Hmm.
Because he said, we play our game, we play fundamentals. Everything mm-hmm. was everything was about fundamentals, mm-hmm. knowing exactly what to do. And I talked to one guy who was one of the athletes on the team, and he said, you could take any of us from any year and put us on the court, and we know exactly what to mm-hmm. do. Which he put together well-oiled machines,
mm-hmm.
and they did their job overall.
It's also striking that nowadays things like mindfulness are very, you know, very, very vogue, very, very prevalent. And when Coach Wooden talks about practice, that's ultimate mindfulness, being present. So I've had that 1.5 hours or 2 hours of practice time. And apparently he planned his practices, you know, several hours for a few hour practice. And when he had that time, it was very dedicated and very, very focused. Which,
he kept the practices interesting.
Mm-hmm.
No practice lasted more than 5 minutes. Hmm. And he had cards that he would prepare for each practice, and they went back his entire career. In mm-hmm. other words, he was always trying to improve it overall, and that's one of the things that made him a great coach. Was
mm-hmm.
The famous story, of course, is him. The first day of practice, he would tell the students, he called them student athletes,
mm-hmm.
he would tell them, this is how you tie your shoes. I'm not kidding.
Right.
Because he said, this is the way you knot them and lace them up.
Why that meticulous?
Because that's how he was.
Right.
He covered everything.
Yeah.
And would also... One of the things that was great about him was, or that was fortunate, is he ultimately had around him a great athletic coach, or who was running the mm-hmm. athletic organization. So he didn't do scheduling anymore. He had a great assistant coach, and he had a great trainer. And once that happened, it really took off. But I asked him that when all those people came together, you know, you got the athletic director. It really happened, and he goes, well, it all happened when I got Pauley Pavilion, because he used to have to play home games in crummy little places, you know, until the university finally built a great place for him.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, he had fun. There was joy in his life. He had a graduate degree in English
mm-hmm.
and was a poet and read poetry and knew that. He was very religious. He didn't drink at all. He had... People that knew him, when I met him, he was a funny guy,
mm-hmm.
very amusing, very witty, and ultimately just gracious. Another thing about his life, which is worth considering, is that after he retired in 1975, he had a heart attack when he was 64, he retired at 65, and he could have gone on, and he could have coached pro team
sure.
for us and do that. He then, and his wife died, he was very sad about that, and ultimately the next 25 years of his life was fantastic. He was giving speeches and being honored and meeting people and had a great life. So it shows you that, I think some writer once said there's no second acts in life. That's not true. There was for him.
Hmm.
You know, so you want to do great things, good things, all of us.
Also struck me as somebody that had a very very profound attitude towards adversity, and almost welcomed it or understood its benefits.
Well, that's life. You're always pushing.
Yes.
And he said that the person who's never had failure will never know success.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't learn from your failures, then that's how you're going to learn overall. Imagine the adversity he faced all the time, but he had, he had it with equanimity, and he told all of the players, you're here first and foremost for an education, and next comes basketball. That's the opposite of the way it is today.
It is, yeah.
In America, the players, after their first year, if they're any good, they go pro, et cetera. And he was very proud that upwards of 90% of his players graduated from UCLA, which is one of the best institutions in America.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't happen anymore in America.
Could he coach today? I mean, obviously the fundamentals he could coach, but Do you think he would have the same level of success today?
You know, he had one of those personalities where I hesitate to use the word commanded respect. He didn't demand it, but he was such a powerful presence in his own quiet, even unassuming way that he would have been I think he would have been a success at everything. Until I said to him once, "Don't you think you would have been a great success in business?" He goes, "I hope not."
No. He never aspired to that, did he?
Not at all. Mm-hmm. He was not interested in money. When he retired in 75, his salary was $32,000, which today would probably be $80,000-$90,000. Yeah. But, you know, the coach at UCLA today is making like, you know, a couple million. So
outside of the United States, it's astounding that the top paid public employee in most states is a basketball or a football coach. Mm-hmm. It's hard to.
Yeah, I know football coaches make more than the chancellors.
Yes,
they bring home the bucks.
Yes,
they bring money for, and that's what Wooden did with his UCLA team. He put UCLA on the map around the world, such that people would come to buy their T-shirts and jerseys and things like that. Overall, and he this thing this the full court press is something that's used today throughout the world and in politics of saying when you're really coming at somebody, it's a full court press, and that was Wooden to popularize that.
Yeah, did you play basketball? Did you have a
no? And to be honest with you, I wasn't. You know, I was interested in it. I knew who he was, but I wasn't a huge fan overall. Mm-hmm. I was a fan of the man. I became a fan of the man, and that's what shows you how interesting life can be. Mm. As a result of my becoming interested in the Pyramid of Success, I learned everything there was to learn about college basketball and the politics of college basketball and how it all worked and the history of it. And I interviewed 200 people, and it was just so much fun, to do that and to see how the sport evolved. Another thing I should say about Wooden that is admirable is that he helped integrate basketball, in the 50s and very early 60s. They didn't have white players. I mean, they didn't have black players on white teams.
Right.
And other coaches said, well, you know what? We're not playing those white teams. Mm. And they forced the integration of basketball overall. And he was so great in that regard because he said, he never saw color at all. It was all about what you could do. So that's another thing that's admirable about him. The other thing that's very important to know about him was the love of his wife, Nell, who he had known since grammar school.
Mm.
And they just had the greatest marriage overall. And, that was the most important thing in his life. He said, family comes first, and then the Lord. And I hope the Lord will understand.
It must have been a wonderful experience to be around him and kind of soaking up the wisdom. And
it's just not that money. Look, I'm not intimidated by too many people in my life, but it was like being with the president or the pope. I mean, it was such an honor. Such an honor because he's that special to our country, to sports, and to our culture. You know that I'm lucky. I got to do this.
Can you talk a little bit about how any of that translated into your professional success? Because I did want to talk a little bit about some of the work that you do professionally. You had a big case, I think, against Universal, if I'm not mistaken.
I'm currently involved in the six class actions were filed mm-hmm. against the movie studios for underpayment on home video mm-hmm. for talent, writers, directors, producers, actors. And we've settled with three of the studios now, and there are three more cases pending. Those are really big cases to do. Put together a team of other law firms, and we're against the top law firms in town, and we are achieving good results overall. But I'll give you, one of the things I'm most proud of doing. So anyway, I have a big career representing, but sometimes very, very famous people, superstars, saying they should have been paid properly. But let me say this about Wooden. Mm-hmm. The thing I'm most proud of doing in my life is writing the book on Coach Wooden. Mm. And the reason is because it was so difficult to do, and it was so difficult because once I had compiled all of the information, massive amounts of articles and things written about him, right. I interviewed all these people. I go, where do I start right. to do it? So right. I had a number of false starts, but ultimately got it together. As a lawyer, I'm very proud of having sued the ABC television network for a television magazine news show they had called Primetime Live, where they used the hidden camera to go in and say that my clients were bad people. They were tarot card readers on a 900 line. And that case was me, little old me, against big lawyers and a big network in which they tried to crush me. And my clients ended up winning that lawsuit, getting the first judgment in the history of the United States for more than $1 for invasion of privacy in a news gathering context, the first judgment in the history of the United States for punitive damages. And I helped establish the contours and boundaries of news gathering in America. In other words, what is the right of privacy? And I basically was saying, you don't get to break some law, like contract or privacy, to go in and find out about somebody because you think there's something there. You're not the FBI. You're not the cops. You need a warrant to do this kind of stuff. And lives can get ruined, and did, in that case. And so I won that case, and then I went to the Court of Appeal. We went to the Court of Appeal, and I lost. I lost 2-1. And then we went to the California Supreme Court, and I won 7-0. And now the case is studied in law schools across America in three different case books, etc. And that was just an incredible journey, and Wooden helped me along the way because I said, darn it, I'm going to win, and I'm going to make this happen. Mm-hmm. So those are the things that I've done. And now we have 9 lawyers here, and we are, doing our best to help people in a variety of ways, whether it be in the privacy area or in the business area. Overall, particularly in the entertainment business. And the entertainment business is a pretty ruthless, tough industry.
I can imagine. Yeah. I'm interested as well in, a lot of very interesting directions. And you don't have to name any names, but, you've represented famous people. And I'm interested in, I guess, the concept of ego and whether or not, you must have had some people that are great clients and some people that are, maybe difficult clients. I don't know if you can compare and contrast approaches to you've got this sort of foundational figure in John Wooden that you've worked with for a while, but I'm just curious how that's translated into, for example, dealing with clients.
Well, we have a number of difficult clients who are not well known.
Yeah, I'm sure as well. Yeah.
For the most part, we get along with our clients, or they're not too demanding. But sometimes it's, that's one of the aspects of being a lawyer is that you have people who are trying to be bossy and tell you what to do, how to do your business, or are too demanding, or spend too much of your time. So you just try and cope with them as best you can. I think one of the things that one should understand about the lawyer-client relationship is that the lawyer, this lawyer is getting into trouble with this a lot. The lawyer is not, the client is not your friend.
Mm-hmm.
I'm here to do a professional job as an attorney, and if I was an accountant or a psychiatrist or an MD, I would have different obligations. Confidentiality is one that's in pretty much every one of those relationships. As a psychiatrist should never be involved sexually with a patient, etc. And that's an area of some can happen. It can be allowable in the legal profession to some degree, but it's obviously a problematic area overall. And I'm saying that my relationships with clients, I mean, I think back now, having been a lawyer for 42 years, that there are very few, you only have about, you have your family and then you have maybe two or three best friends or really close friends in life. That's all you have time for as a human being. The rest of the people you have are acquaintances. I wouldn't qualify any of my present or former clients as best friends.
Mm-hmm.
And looking back over this period of time, yeah, I still may see a few of them, but I'm not necessarily going to be staying at their home.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when I go travel to be near them, etc. And you during the period of the relationship between attorney and client, it is like family and can be. I learn everything there is to know about the client because they want to tell me because they want to win the case. And I want to know and need to know overall, but it's ephemeral. It's not going to last past the close of the case overall,
Sure. Ordinarily.
And so we try and teach that to our students in law school overall, generally speaking. But it's one of the issues that we have to face as counsel.
Sure. In terms of the work that you've done taking on major corporates, big corporates, what have been some of the keys to your success in doing that? Corporates, do they just sort of bully people around and try to, you know, if you're going up against, you talked about teams of lawyers that are, you know, highly well-paid, very skilled, and if you're taking on a client who's maybe the smaller party, the party with the fewer resources, strategically, how do you look at something like that? How do you approach it?
We don't really usually take on cases on contingency unless they're worth a certain amount of money, which is fairly high. We can't, you know, and to hire a lawyer today is out of range for most people in the middle class.
Mm-hmm.
So if it comes to a personal injury case and somebody's really been seriously injured, there's a lot of personal injury lawyers out there. I don't do that kind of work. I do a great job and will spend the money that it takes, which can be millions of dollars sometimes, say for a wrongful death or something like that. We sometimes work on a contingency basis and we'll go against big corporations, and sometimes we'll do it in a class action basis, as we have with the motion picture companies on the home video business, because we know there's enough money there at the end of the day to pay us. But myself and my colleagues will spend millions of dollars, both in hard costs, some hard costs, and also our time, because you know, we have overhead and all the rest of that, to do that. So it's a question of risk and reward overall, but key to this is having the ability, in other words, the strength to fight the corporation.
Mm-hmm.
So having worked in the industry for all of these years, I have the knowledge of knowing, you know, how to navigate the straits of difficulty in these kinds of cases, and I have a pretty good, and we have a pretty good sense of, you know, we like to say we take the low-hanging fruit cases. We want the ones we know we're pretty sure we're going to win overall. We do for the most part, but the counsel that we fight are formidable and excellent and top-notch and are going to fight, and they don't just roll over. So we have to be, we choose our battles carefully, and then when we get involved with them, we match them.
Mm-hmm.
Our work, we like to think, is as good as their work overall. Let's go to a third-party judge and let them decide. So that's it. It's like what preparation, what Wooden would say,
mm-hmm.
you know, we're we're prepared, we have the skill and the stamina.
Mm-hmm. I did want to talk about your work in privacy law, and I don't want to get into the technicalities because, you know, the laws are different. We have different laws here in the UK and the EU, but the world of privacy is changing. Just like we're having this great conversation, similarly, somebody can share something across the world that that they wouldn't want to have made public, and there's all kinds of ways in which privacy can be violated. In terms of how I guess individuals can first of all, what do you see as sort of the major risks to our privacy in this digital age?
Well, it's no secret that the social networks and others are grabbing every single piece of data that you can imagine. There are entities that keep them, that try and be as secretive as possible, that will have all the data points on an individual, from their political party to their preferences for sports, TV shows, or whatever else it may be, and they're just gathering it all the time, and that's how they market and utilize the information. How privacy has changed for me, at least in the last 10 or 20 years, is that the generation X and Y have given it all away with Facebook and Instagram and all the rest of that. And there seems to be a lessening of awareness of the importance of privacy overall. And privacy is a fundamental right in any country of the world. It takes a while for legislatures and the law to catch up with technology as it changes. The EU had a big decision 4 or 5 years ago where a Spanish lawyer said, yeah, I had a bankruptcy 15 years before. That doesn't mean it still should be public overall. And they went to the highest court for the EU, which said that, yes, you have a right to be forgotten. And you can fill out a form for Google, and they have to look at it and respect it in many situations, or they can get into trouble overall. And many tens of thousands of people have said, take this off, take this off. America is much more different, is different, and doesn't have that same kind of a right overall. And I think our country is going to have to come to grips with it at some point. In other words, in America, the social providers such as the ISPs, like Facebook, are immune from claims that they have violated privacy or defamation.
Right.
Because of the federal law we have, and that's just really horrible for a lot of people in the world, in America. Where somebody may have said something defamatory, and all you can do is sue the person who said it, but you can't make them take it down on Facebook necessarily. And Facebook doesn't care, and Twitter, well, they say they care, but they don't really do what I think they should be doing in these situations. Anyway, privacy is a huge, huge, huge problem. In terms of what is, you might be interested to know the levels of privacy. The highest levels of privacy certainly be sexuality and medical. In other words, you don't get to know anything about my sexual practices, preferences, etc., and you should not be nosing around or putting out information relating to my physical health and well-being. And I think we all get that overall. But I think education is important for us from now on in terms of privacy, and it's going to be a worldwide battle going on between the internet service providers and the data collectors and the people who are the public. And the problem is that there's no institutional organization really that is out there that can match the power of these mega companies in saying we got to protect privacy overall, because you don't know that how important privacy is until you've been invaded. And the last thing you want to do is say, oh, this came out about me. about that, you know.
So everything that, how can individuals protect themselves? And is it true that, you know, anything that I post on Facebook, for instance, becomes the property of Facebook? Is that more or less how it works?
I'm no expert on that. I don't think I want to go so far as to say that, but I'm aware of one website. I will tell you, I'm not going to name it because they're so despicable, that says if you write a review, and there are usually bad reviews, we own the copyright from that point going forward. You can't even take it down later. Mm. And I think that is just wrong overall.
Mm-hmm.
You need to be careful about that. Once you put it up there, it's archived and more or less, I believe, in perpetuity.
Yeah, and I think we're almost past the point of no return, perhaps, because, you know, big data is the next big thing. Making money off of, you know, collecting data, algorithms, predicting things. It's a little bit it's scary.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I want to be respectful of your time, and I'm keen to kind of wrap things up here. But was there anything that we didn't get to cover that you wanted to make mention of?
Well, I put out a book of poetry.
Oh, brilliant.
Last year, 167 love poems to my wife, called What Took You So Long. And if your listeners are interested in music, I lead a band and I write songs and I play guitar under the name Trevor McShane. And there are videos up on YouTube.
Okay.
I'm going to be putting out a lot more music this year.
Where can people find all that?
YouTube, you can get it, and some of the stuff's on Amazon and iTunes.
Great. I'll put the various.
That's what I do.
That's what you do for fun, is it?
Yeah.
What kind of music is it?
I call it folk rock, country pop.
Mm-hmm.
I get compared with Mark Knopfler, Lou Reed, Bob Dylan,
okay.
Leonard Cohen, Eagles, Jimmy Buffett.
It doesn't strike me as the hobby of a typical lawyer, but you don't strike me as a typical lawyer.
You know, there's a lot of, you'd be surprised. Mm. In fact, there's a battle of the bands that happened last weekend of all lawyer bands,
right,
which I was not in because they said you could only have one ringer, and my band is all ringers. Everybody's is a pro except for me. You know, I say this, that you don't have to do just one thing in life. And why can't I write a book about John Wooden?
Mm.
You know, I own a book publishing company as well with my wife. Publishes the Wooden books, and also we've done books about legendary rock and roll, the autobiographies of two legendary rock and roll people, Lloyd Price, who did Lottie Miss Claudie and Stagger Lee and Personality, and Mitch Ryder, who's famous for Devil with a Blue Dress, and we published some political business oriented books,
okay,
some fiction, and I'm saying I want to have a fulfilled life.
Yeah.
And this is my way of relaxing, you know.
Yeah. It's a brilliant way of rounding out your life, and you know, we have different identities, don't we? And if you invest too much of your identity in being a lawyer, then something else is going to suffer, and
I adverted to that earlier in my younger days. I was too consumed with being a lawyer.
Mm-hmm. Well, it sounds like you've certainly broken out of that. So. This has been a wonderful conversation, Neville. I really appreciate your time and taking the time to speak to me. I'll put all the links in the show notes, and people can look you up and find you. But I wanted to thank you very sincerely for coming on and speaking with me.
Well, it was good to do this. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you, Neville.
All right.
Bye for now. I hope you guys enjoyed that. Definitely check out the show notes once again. You don't have to remember anything. Just go to the show notes at allthingsrisk.co.uk. That's the only thing you need to remember. And you can find everything that we talked about, all the links, all the wonderful stuff, and it will be there for your convenience. And if you like the show and you're wondering how you can help support it, here's one great way. Leave a rating and a review on iTunes. What that does is it helps more people discover the show and bumps us up in the various algorithms that iTunes uses. I've also been thinking about doing a few different things, additional things with the show. For instance, I was thinking about doing a few of the intros on video as well, so you could check those out. I'm really wondering what you think. You can send me any feedback about that or anything about the show at allthingsrisk@gmail.com. If you have any suggestions for episodes, for guests, for anything like that, I would love to hear from you as always. We will be back in 2 weeks' time, because next week I'll be cycling in Italy and I won't be available to produce an episode. So you might want to catch up on any episodes that you may have missed. Our back catalog is quite considerable now and it's certainly growing. And if you don't want to miss the next episode, subscribe. Allthingsrisk.co.uk is the place. You can also do that on allthingsrisk.com if that's a little bit easier for you. Subscribe and you won't miss anything. We will be back in 2 weeks' time in the interim. And as always, don't forget, risk is life.